Ultimate Evil, subtitled An Investigation into America's Most Dangerous Satanic Cult. The book is written by Maury Terry, first name M-A-U-R-Y, last name Terry. And the book is published by, it's a Dolphin book, published by Doubleday & Company, copyright 1987. So Maury Terry's The Ultimate Evil.
Now, what this book is about, basically, is it links many of the brutal serial killers of the last 20 years or so together. The subtitle of The Ultimate Evil is called An Investigation of America's Most Dangerous Satanic Cult with New Evidence Linking Charlie Manson and the Son of Sam. In the time that we have here, we're not even going to begin to be able to do justice to this book. In a nutshell, basically, what they're talking about with The Ultimate Evil is the fact that some of the horrible crimes which America has experienced over the last two decades or so are not, in fact, the work of lone nuts any more than the killing of President Kennedy was the work of a lone nut. In fact, it appears that occultists, specifically devil worshippers, and as we'll go into later in the broadcast, it appears that devil worship is merely the front for this particular type of activity, although many of the dupes involved at the operational level probably do believe in this kind of thing. But that basically what we have here is an insidious form of organized crime, one which is explicitly Nazi and touches on some of the occult connections to Nazism, and which appears to have links not only to local police departments and very influential professional people, but quite probably to our own intelligence system as well. One of the things that we talked about in Radio Free America number 5, which is going to be coming up on Wednesday, October 28th on KKUP, 8 to midnight, was the fact that one of the things that our national security establishment has been involved in is the deliberate programming of hypno-killers. People who are particularly described as passive-aggressive personalities are subjected to increasing degrees of visual violence. They're shown films of people being mutilated and killed in accidents and things of this type, so that gradually they become desensitized to human suffering and bloodshed. We can't even begin to do credit to this book in the time allotted here. We'll probably go back to it next week, and eventually we'll probably have to do an archive show on it. But in a nutshell, it appears that this satanic cult, and we're going to talk more about this in a second, is, in effect, an organized crime cabal, and specifically appears to have a mind control function. The people at the operational level are apparently practicing Satanists and devil worshippers, you know, with blood-drinking ceremonies and the black mass and all that kind of stuff. But it appears, as we're going to look at, that the people controlling this may or may not believe in that, but they certainly have ulterior motives. The crimes that this organized crime syndicate is involved in include drug smuggling, murder, kiddie porn, prostitution, the making of snuff flicks, weapon smuggling, cocaine smuggling from Colombia via Miami, heroin smuggling via Hawaii from Southeast Asia. Obviously, these are things we've looked at in the past in connection with the intelligence services. Now, in a nutshell, the Son of Sam killings, the 44 killings in New York City, are linked in a hard way with this organized crime cult, which is what I'm going to refer to it as. It appears to be, to a considerable measure, an intelligence front as well. In addition, they link the Manson killings to this same group, and they point out that both Manson and David Berkowitz, the man convicted in the Son of Sam killings, while parts of this group were basically selected as fall guys. In other words, the really powerful people are being protected. They were simply run in as the lone nuts, as the Lee Harvey Oswalds, or whatever. Now, the cult itself appears to be an offshoot and involve elements of a number of different occult organizations. People, now we're not impugning the Church of Scientology, nor are we endorsing it, but elements of the Scientology organization, in particular, spin-offs of Scientologists, have generated a cult called The Process. We're going to go into what The Process is, and then again, elements of The Process, not necessarily the whole thing, but most of it, have in turn hooked up with members of Aleister Crowley's OTO organization. That was an occult group founded in Germany in 1902. Well, actually, the Golden Dawn merged with Crowley's OTO. Crowley was a so-called black adept, a person who believed in black magic and participated in it. As we're going to look at in a future book about a future program about UFO cults, in other words, people that worship the, quote, UFOs, and who in turn appear to be explicitly connected to the intelligence community and Nazi elements, were that Aleister Crowley himself worked as an intelligence agent both for Britain and the United States, and Nazi Germany. So there are strong intelligence connections to Aleister Crowley. The cult we're talking about appears to involve elements of Scientology, primarily dissident elements, and in particular, The Process itself, which in turn was founded by a couple of wayward Scientologists, people who were involved with L. Ron Hubbard's organization and then broke off, spun off to form their own cult. In turn, elements of the process, with a capital P, hooked up with elements of Aleister Crowley's OTO. And this is the cult we're talking about. And I want to make the point clear, we're not necessarily pointing the finger at any of all of those organizations, although the process appears to be essentially an infernal, literally a devil-worshipping organization. But we don't want to say, okay, this is what the Scientologists do. We're talking about elements of these groups, in particular elements which spun off and formed their own organization. But this is the organization behind the Manson killings, behind so many of these serial killings that we've been looking at. And one of the things that I think is so important about this book, it not only points out that these aren't the work of lone nuts, but that all of these killers are hooked together. They're part of a crime syndicate. They are protected by the authorities. And in particular, they are explicitly Nazi. This is the organization we're talking about here. Next week, perhaps, we'll go into the long series of killings that were initiated to cover up the work of this particular organization. But we're not talking about the devil here, although one could think about it that way. What we're looking at is something which uses the occult as a front. And it should be noted here, as we're going to talk about in future broadcasts, that occult organizations have long been favored by by intelligence agents as covers, specifically because they tend to exist at the periphery of public scrutiny and are therefore good covers. Beyond that, because they do a lot of weird things, it serves as a very good cover for activities which might otherwise look very strange. But this is the David, again, Berkowitz, Manson, and many others were involved with the organization, but equally importantly, were not only operating by themselves, but were not even the primary element here. The primary elements, the controlling elements, appear to be very, very well off, very well connected, with ties to organized crime, local police departments, and in all probability, our own intelligence system. But again, this cult here is a combination of elements from the Scientologists, primarily dissident spin-off elements, the Process Church, and Aleister Crowley's OTO. Those are the groups behind, that's the organization behind all of these killings, and the point for our purposes here is they are explicitly Nazi.
Okay, we're going to have some other names in here that will be unfamiliar because, again, we're starting with a section almost 400 pages into this book, and there's been a great deal run before that, and we'll get back to Dave and let him explain who some of these folks are. Anyway, at first they're talking about some ex-cult devotees who are talking to the author.
Right, the Danny and Vinny mentioned here were prison informants who had been providing the authors as well as police investigators with a lot of information about this group. It's big, a lot of people know about it, and some of the people that helped unearth the investigation by Maury, Terry, and others were informants in prison with some of the people connected with the cult.
Okay, according to Danny and Vinny, writes Maury Terry, the cult originated in England. They didn't know the names Process, Chingon, which is who's a high muckamuck code name in the cult, or OTO. But the English origin information was enough to put it over the top. Both the Process and Aleister Crowley's OTO were rooted in England. The group had a main headquarters near Los Angeles, and both confirmed that Manson II was from L.A. and was involved in the Arliss Perry murder.
Yeah, Manson II, by the way, was a fellow linked with Charlie Manson. He appears to have been one of the main Son of Sam killers and a primary controlling element in this particular cult. Arliss Perry was a woman from Bismarck, North Dakota, who was a devout Christian activist and was murdered in the Stanford University Church in 1974 in a ritualistic killing by this group. By the way, one of the points that they make in this book is that some killings are performed for ritualistic black mass purposes. Other killings are specific assassinations, that individuals have been targeted by one element or another for one reason or another, and that other killings are performed simply to cover those up. They're simply random killings meant to obscure the others as kind of deadly camouflage.
Okay, the group had a main headquarters near Los Angeles, and both confirmed that Manson II was from L.A. and was involved in the Arliss Perry murder. He was also involved in at least one Son of Sam shooting, they said, that of Christine Freund. Vinny's description of the cult's philosophy also matched that espoused by the original Process, and generally that of the OTO. He explained the theology in depth to a minister friend of his who wrote, quote, "The cult bases its theology on a strange mixture of apocalypses from Daniel, Revelation, 2 Esdras, 2 Adam and Eve, and the Gospel of the Essenes. Of particular interest is the timetable in Daniel and the Beast of Revelation, whose number is 666. According to Daniel, after a, quote, time, two times, and half a time, there will be a, quote, time of trouble such as never been since there was a nation until that time," unquote. The cult interprets this, the minister writes, to be 2,300 years after the book of Daniel was written, and we are now in that time of trouble. According to Revelation, Satan was an angel who was cast out of heaven and bound on earth. Earth is his realm. God is supreme, and the worship of Christ is elevating a man to the position of a deity. This is wrong, the cult thinks. Satan is the one who should be worshipped on earth to hasten the coming of the day of the Lord. This day must be preceded by the time of trouble, the Armageddon of Revelation, and one goal of the cult is to help it along by promoting dissension, confusion, and Holocaust. They look upon the destruction wrought by Hitler as a warm-up for what's coming. They want to be in on the big event. They see their murders, etc., as a divine mission. The Reverend wrote that the marks of the cult, its signs were 666, HT and HH for Hitler, and the German SS lightning bolts. Quote, all are marks of the beast Satan-Hitler whom they serve. This information, Maury Terry writes, was confirmed by the fact that the initials HH, never made public, were written on the back of the envelope in which Berkowitz enclosed one of the threatening letters he mailed to Sam Carr. We also possess information contained in a 1977 police report in which an acquaintance of Berkowitz stated that Berkowitz, quote, possessed and wore Nazi insignia. Of course, along with numerous other items, including at least two guns, Vinny and Danny said Berkowitz owned, these articles were missing from his Yonkers apartment at the time of his arrest.
And again, note the fact that Berkowitz himself, who incidentally was born as a religious Jew, while in the military, all of a sudden made an astounding conversion to fundamentalist Christianity. He became a charismatic Christian, and incidentally, the military also appears to be involved with this cult. He went down to Houston, bought his weapons from a former buddy of his in the military, and there are links to the national security establishment that go throughout this whole process. The process here can be meant literally. Again, more about this process, OTO link, and their explicitly Nazi philosophy. The group reasoned that Hitler was worthy of worship for several reasons, one of which, the informant said, was a numerology timetable in which each letter of the alphabet was assigned a number. Under this system, A equaled 100 and Z was matched with 125. The numbers, which corresponded to the letters in Hitler's last name, 107, 108, 119, 111, 104, and 117, added to 666, the number of the great beast of the biblical book of Revelation, the devil's number. This is by way of running down the philosophy behind this particular group.
That's right. If you just happen to tune into the show tonight, and you hear Dave and I reading things about the Beast of Revelations and the Book of Daniel and et cetera, it should be noted that we are talking about, in fact, a cult and the beliefs of a cult, according to a book called The Ultimate Evil by Maury Terry. And, in fact, we have not finally had our signal jammed by one of those strange religious stations that some of our callers have alluded to.
This is by way of showing some of the things that can come out of that sort of indoctrination.
Yes, out of some strange religious sort of organizations. Again, talking about the cult and the process out of which one of the organizations out of which it sprung. The official process symbol paying homage to the idolized Hitler was a form of inverted swastika. Skipping down. Now, the process put out a magazine called Process, containing all kinds of really bizarre stuff about their particular philosophy and their symbolism and things of that nature. A subsequent issue of Process magazine was devoted to, quote, fear. On the back cover of this publication, a band of marching Nazis spewed from the mouth of a fiery pink skull. The Nazis were tramping on a group of people being consumed by fire. Elsewhere in the same illustration, the face of Hitler appeared in a funhouse mirror, and a human being was shown burning to death. Okay, skipping on down. So what we have here is a great deal of explicitly Nazi symbolism in this particular organization, the Process, which is one of the key roots for the organization that Maury Terry is writing about.
Bear in mind that Berkowitz, the alleged lone nut of the Son of Sam killings in New York City, was known to sport explicit Nazi paraphernalia.
Skipping down. What the Process had managed to do was to envelop isolated weirdness freaks from various social backgrounds and mix them together. It was a volatile brew, and the common cause resulted in long-standing alliances being sealed. The author here, Maury Terry, I have spoken to several professional people, including educators, who remain sympathetic to the group's theology. So any impression that the cult managed to attract only society's misfits would be erroneous. Kind of a disturbing thought right there. Skipping on down farther, as the cult went underground, there in the aftermath of the assassination of Senator Robert Kennedy, meaning in Los Angeles, where, of course, RFK was assassinated, in parentheses, perhaps concerned that law enforcement would hear of Sirhan Sirhan's occult interests and alleged acquaintance with a process member, secret process chapters, or spin-offs using other names, were established in Northern and Southern California. Skipping on down after they talk about several of them, including some taking place in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and specifically a gentleman by the name of Stanley Baker arrested for a murder. Baker, who sported a swastika tattoo and other occult emblems, said he was recruited from a campus setting in Wyoming. He participated in blood-drinking rituals there, was further programmed, and then joined the California activities. And they're talking specifically about Santa Cruz, the Santa Cruz Mountains at this point. Skipping down, this cult, a process splinter group, was said by the witnesses to call itself the 4P Movement, or 4Pi, P-I. Its leader, alleged to be a prosperous L.A. businessman or doctor, was known as the Grand Chingon, or Chingon, C-H-I-N-G-O-N. Interestingly, Ed Sanders stated that on several occasions, in his presence, Manson family members referred to Charlie as the Grand Chingon. However, Manson was under arrest at the time, and the cult was still functioning, so he was not the Grand Chingon. So, interestingly enough, a reference by these process members to their cult leader by one name, and a separate reference by Ed Sanders, who, of course, wrote one of the well-known books on the Manson family cult, as the Manson family members referring to Charlie Manson as being, using the same name, the Grand Chingon.
It's also interesting that the this particular cult went underground after the assassination of Robert Kennedy. One of the things that we've spoken about in Radio Free America number 12, first of all, the Robert Kennedy's campaign managers in the L.A. area were Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski. The evening before he was assassinated, he revealed in a dinner at their home that he'd have to wait until he got into the White House before he could reopen his brother's murder. In fact, his brother's murder was eventually reopened and basically endorsed the results of Garrison's investigation. However, Robert Kennedy was not to live more than 24 hours after that, and Sharon Tate was not to live a whole lot longer after that. Polanski lucked out and was not at the house at the time. Another thing we talked about in Radio Free America number 12 was how Ed Butler, the U.S. Army intelligence agent who was instrumental in painting Oswald red, turned up in Los Angeles in the employ of Knight of Malta Patrick Frawley and began publishing in a a right-wing paper that this was obviously the work of the Black Panthers or other left-wing radicals. And it's worth noting, too, that another thing we talked about in Radio Free America 12 was how Charlie Manson is now a tremendous hero among certain California Nazi groups. And, in fact, there's a picture of him in one of the aggregations here in this particular book. And it has an interesting picture of Charlie Manson. Well, let me find it here. In the middle of his head, in the middle of his forehead, he has a swastika carved. Let me find the exact picture. Here we go. And so you can see what right in the middle of the boy's head there, right where the third eye should be.
Yep.
We don't have no third eye. We got ourselves a swastika. Again, reflecting on the connections to the assassination of Robert Kennedy, the explicit Nazi elements and information we talked about in Radio Free America number 12, with Manson as an idol for Nazi elements in this country. And again, more Nazi connections to the Son of Sam Manson organization. Berkowitz signed a threatening letter to neighbor Glassman with brother, another process level, and he'd written HH on the envelope of one of the anonymous letters he mailed to Sam Carr. That also was a neighbor. This, I would later learn, signified Heil Hitler, a process demigod. Regarding Hitler process links, which also brought Fred Cowan into the fold, C-O-W-A-N, I would learn that an associate of Berkowitz's told police in 1977 that Berkowitz frequented the White Plains Road area of the Northeast Bronx and, quote, possessed and wore Nazi insignia, unquote. So again, more Nazi connections to David Berkowitz and the Son of Sam cult running out to the Manson family and very, very powerful elements thereof.
And I believe Fred Cowan, if I remember correctly, was somebody who himself was a mass murderer and killed like six people and just happened to have at one point like either lived in the same house that Berkowitz had lived in or they had mutual friends of some kind.
We're about to review that connection right now.
Okay, good. Here we are. All right, reading another section here. Maury Terry, the author, is talking to a man by the name of Mittiger.
He's a fellow investigator, Jim Mittiger, I believe a former New York City policeman, but I'd have to check. A lot of his fellow investigators were former or active duty cops.
Okay. Now, if there's references to I, it's Maury Terry talking about himself. Now, what's this about Jack Cassera from New Rochelle? Mittiger explained that Cassera, C-A-S-S-A-R-A, from whom Berkowitz, again, that's David Berkowitz, the son of Sam, from whom Berkowitz rented a room in early 1976, was a co-worker of Fred Cowan, an avowed neo-Nazi who murdered six people before killing himself during a day-long siege at the Neptune Moving Company in New Rochelle on Valentine's Day, 1977. Moreover, Berkowitz kept a file of news clippings on Cowan in his Yonkers apartment and had referred to him as, quote, one of the sons. Quote, did you know that? Mittiger asked. Yes, I found that out in August. I've been saying up here that if I was Cassara, I'd have written a first-person article for Reader's Digest on, quote, my most unforgettable characters. Mittiger laughed and then turned serious. What do you think the odds are that one guy, Cassara, would have Son of Sam living in his house and work with Fred Cowan during the day? And then have Berkowitz with a file on Cowan, I cut in. I'd say the odds were incalculable. And we don't know how the hell Berkowitz ended up finding Cassara's place either. Mittiger was on the edge of his seat now. Maybe Cowan knew from Cassara the room was available, and that's how Berkowitz found out. It makes sense. It's certainly possible. I think there's a lot of smoke there, and there just might be a fire to go with it. Mittiger and I agreed that if the scenario was correct, Jack Cassara, then in his mid-60s, was almost certainly an innocent link between the two murderers. But we also concurred that it was too much to think there was no connection between Cowan and Berkowitz, especially in light of Berkowitz's comments about the Hitler-worshipping killer.
And again, due to the limitations of time, we're not going to be able to do justice to this book. We'll come back to it during part of the prepared portion next week. Eventually, we'll have to do an archive show, I think, on this type of material. This book in particular, Mae Russell has been pointing out for a number of years her thesis, which has endured her, by the way, a lot of scorn at the hands of many people, that in fact all of these serial killers were in fact a form of agent provocateur. What this is basically, according to Mae's thesis, and it appears to be borne out in terrifying fashion and degree by this particular book, is that this is a type of application of the strategy of tension, that if you take a society and you unleash all of these horrendous screwball killers, or killers we're told are screwballs, it has the effect of driving the political spectrum to the right. People want law and order, they want stronger laws, more cops, more jails, quicker capital punishment, and in general, it predisposes them to accepting the incredible. It's just, well, with all those nuts out there, you never know who's going to do what. So if 900 people commit suicide in the middle of the jungle under preposterous circumstances, or if lone nuts come forward to begin killing politicians, there's a context which in which that occurs. But again, this is a way of driving people to the right. These horrible killings, these apparent screwballs running all over the place, just gives the impression of a society that is decaying. And what we need is law and order. We need a Führer. We need someone to set this right. We need George Bush. Yeah.
George. Again, for those of you who haven't had a chance to go out and get this book, which is probably most of you since it's very new, and again, if you want an example of something we've talked about in the past, that's the way that these kind, if you're wondering how these things can crop up and then they just get ignored this way, or they get downplayed, or why don't people talk about these things, why, we talked at great length about the fact that, that John Hinckley took a shot at Ronald Reagan, not only had heavy connections between his family and George Bush's family, which, let's face it, no Agatha Christie-type mystery in the world would get away with something as obvious as far as a plot twist. But then on top of it, John Hinckley was a member of a Nazi group and had a Nazi uniform and went to Nazi rallies, and there were interviews in the newspaper with his Nazi buddies who said, gee, we always thought the guy was the heat. We thought he had to be a government agent. He was so crazy. And then when John Hinckley's trial came along, both the defense and the prosecution agreed that the Nazi part of John Hinckley's career was entirely a figment of John Hinckley's imagination. And even after there'd been national newspaper articles with his old Nazi Bund mates talking about him, then the prosecution and defense managed to agree that there was no such thing as John Hinckley's Nazi past. So if you folks think that, if you wonder how something like the some of these details about David Berkowitz or the Manson family can scoot by under the table, just remember that one, which was only 7 years ago.
One of the most ominous connections here is that there are connections to very powerful elements, including elements of police, elements of the military and intelligence community. I would have preferred that Maury Terry went even farther than he did, but this is a masterpiece of investigation and really is going to open up a whole new area of political research for people. Now, one of the things that's most important for us to understand is that the Satanism is largely a cover. In other words, the people used at the operational level, God have mercy on them, do appear to believe in this sickness. But that the point is the people who run it, the ones who do not take the falls, like the Berkowitzes and the Mansons, apparently do not believe in Satan, or if they do, they're using this group for ulterior motives. And basically, it's an organized crime syndicate that's not only involved in murder, but other things. A couple of sections will give you an idea of what we're talking about. This, again, from another one of the prison informants who helped break the case. Drugs are involved. I feel the real key to exposing the group is through drug and porn connections. Illegal weapons are also, but not as good because that's sporadic, and they already have arsenals. But they need steady supplies of drugs for their own parties and to make money. And remember, those who head this may not believe this crap about Satan. They believe in how people can be led and used in a very effective way, sickeningly effective, and developing still further, skipping down into the book, from the same prison informant, actually a different prison informant. The motive is drugs. I have all the details. Some 44 shootings were hits. Pornography is also involved. Also, snuff films on videotape. I would interrupt that a snuff flick is actually a film of an actual killing. Usually the victim is female and dispatched in an explicitly sexual context, but it's an actual film of an actual killing. Also, snuff films on videotape. And that, sir, is proof. This is not just sick. It is big business. Someone has gotten rich off the bloodshed, and I can back up every single word. I'll give you facts. What you do with them will determine how much you get. You see, I don't trust you. I trust what Lincoln said. You can't make expletive deleteds out of the people forever. I think that's how he said it. That's how I say it. The authorities are elected to protect, not to censor and cover up. Gannett Newspapers is always BSing you care about the public's right to know. Prove it. I've got my expletive deleted on the line. We have a deal to talk, and my writing this letter is a commitment. I'm risking my life. Does that maybe challenge you, unquote? Even if they waste me, you got a story. The children, and these are the, quote, sons alluded to earlier in the Nazi references, the children were very literally being raised to kill. This was a reference to wall writing in Berkowitz's apartment. My children I'm raising to be killers. Wait till they grow up. For very real reasons, there is a black master, unquote. Only he is not an illusion. Dr. Abramson also came close to this realization. Berkowitz feared, that's a psychiatrist assigned to Berkowitz. Berkowitz feared Abramson knew that he figured it out. Check the ballistics report. More than one weapon was used. They can't argue, unquote, about that one. Those conflicting composites do not prove eyewitnesses are worthless. Perhaps they prove the cop DA political mentality is dangerously prejudiced. Sam was a squeaky frome, nothing more glamorous than a patsy. That's a reference to Berkowitz here. He laughed when he was apprehended. Sure, why not? It was orchestrated. Do you believe he actually transported guns like that? No. And the note, left out in the open, the visible gun, it was a setup. The apartment was a setup, made to look like he was nuts. They, the cult, don't want a trial nor an investigation. Things were getting hot. Too many experts were involved. If the investigation continued, the truth would have been found out. And I would say here, take note of this statement from this prison informant, that perhaps they prove the cop DA political mentality is dangerously prejudiced. Another one of our listeners has done a fabulous piece of research which would indicate perhaps some of the people who protect this particular group.
This is a piece of writing that will not be unfamiliar to longtime One Step Beyond listeners. We've devoted a great deal of attention to it off and on in the past. The book itself is entitled The Glass House Tapes, and the book is by the Citizens Research and Investigation Committee, which included, among other people, Mae Brussel and Donald Freed, and written with Lewis E. Tackwood. And the Glass House Tapes themselves are the revelations of Lewis Tackwood, who was a former L.A. Police Department informer and, in fact, basically a secret agent and provocateur, most important for our purposes.
Radio Free America number 23, where we went into this connection at great length.
At great length. And Lewis Tackwood worked with, among other things, organizations that would later be involved in things like the SLA. He had a lot to say about the way that the L.A. Police Department manipulated the prison systems and various so-called left-wing organizations to put up the same kind of things we've been talking about with the Italians, using the strategy of tension. And interestingly, something that we didn't remember, but as mentioned before, one of our longtime co-workers found for us in the Glass House Tapes is this reference from Tackwood. And remember, a lot of the things that Tackwood talked about in this at the time looked pretty strange, and several of them, like the attempt to scuttle the 1972 Republican convention, later turned out to have been, in fact, actual truth. And it just didn't sound like it at the time because they sounded pretty wild. Well, here's another thing of Tackwood's that's looked pretty wild for about 15 years, and now with this publication of the Maury Terry book is beginning to look a little prophetic. Tackwood is again talking about the L.A. Police Department and how they set up some of their provocations. Tackwood had also said, quote, I should mention real quickly before I start reading from the Glasshouse tapes, the copy that we have was a paperback, copyright 1973, published by Avon Books. Tackwood had also said, quote, then, like the dynamite deal, you don't know, but there's a devil worship cult in Pasadena, actually in Altadena. They are definitely on the LAPD payroll.
Repeat that last sentence, because that's exactly where this cult, one of its bases was in the Pasadena or Altadena.
Indeed. Tackwood had also said, quote, then like the dynamite deal, you don't know, but there's a devil worship cult in Pasadena, actually in Altadena. They are definitely on the LAPD payroll, because that's how we set a cat up. That cat with the dynamite. This is a guy who's a member of the Weathermen. He was kind of leery, but I take him up to the temple, meaning this devil cult temple, and these crazy-looking cats come out and say, we're going to blow this up. And he's scared to death. We shook him so it was pathetic. And then how you do it is, from this taxi, that car, and this car to that car, and there's a mystic thing about it, and they go for it every time. I don't care if they're the leader of the Weathermen. If you catch them right, they fall for it. If you could show them, like if I caught the leader of the Weatherman clique, and I had a lot of bread and guns, and I showed them how they could rip off $1 million in gold, and there wasn't going to be anyone there, I could march a squad in there with enough money and enough guns, and if you lay it on right and show him how easy it is, he's going to march right in there and get all shot up. So in this case, they're talking about, among other things, the L.A. Police Department using this devil cult as an operation with which to entrap people like the Weathermen. But obviously, when you're the L.A. Police Department, whose record of their dealings with the public has been less than laudatory, and who a careful reading of the Glasshouse tapes and some of the other stuff that we've presented here on One Step Beyond will show you, the L.A. Police Department is not balk at using just about anything to achieve their ends. And the L.A. Police Department apparently seems to have their fingers in some pretty, pretty strange pies.
Now, to give you an idea of the size and scope of this particular operation, this cult-slash-mind-control intelligence front, as it really appears to be, and an organized crime syndicate of a particularly heinous variety, again, Maury Terry writes as follows in The Ultimate Evil. Cults, as many experts confirmed, change names frequently as circumstances demanded. The actual name wasn't all that important, but the original theology and networking was. As for the claim that approximately 1,000 people nationwide belonged to the cult, this figure, while startling and ominous, was not incredible. Berkowitz, as far back as Marcy in 1978, that's a prison in New York, had said he believed he was protecting hundreds, unquote. And the original process, with its cells in numerous American cities, stated as early as 1969 that 200 people in the United States actually joined the movement. Additionally, the process actively sought alliances with existing occult groups, such as the Crowley-worshipping OTO. So, with expansion and recruitment since then, it was not beyond the realm of possibility that offshoot or related ranks increased their numbers by some 700 or 800 across the country by 1977. And of course, the figure may have been somewhat exaggerated by those who provided it to Berkowitz. Vinny and Danny, those are two prison informants, also quoted Berkowitz as saying Charles Manson was a member of the cult. This, too, blended with everything we learned or would learn, including Berkowitz's offshoot of Scientology remark. Author Ed Sanders and Manson prosecutor Vincent Bugliosi both believe Manson was affiliated with the process. In his book Helter Skelter, Bugliosi said that two process members from Cambridge, Massachusetts, visited him to dissuade him from that belief. Those same two processans then called on Manson in prison, after which Manson stopped talking about the process. I would indicate that other elements in this book, and we're going to go into the many killings committed to, or apparent murders committed to cover up this crime, the claim of 1,000 members may even be an underestimate. It appears that this is a very large and very powerful group. And again, people with tremendous wealth, show business people, professionals, as well as elements of police, military, and the intelligence community appear to be deeply involved. Now, the next section of the book that we're going to read is a description of Arliss Perry, one of the victims of this particular organization. She apparently had come across one of the branches of this cult in North Dakota, where she lived. She then moved to Palo Alto with her husband, who was beginning his sophomore year at Stanford. She was a Christian activist and spent a lot of time in church, and apparently she was followed to that church and was murdered in the Stanford church in October of 1974. Berkowitz was aware of all of the details of her killing. This is by way of making people aware of just of the nature of this particular beast. This is going to be some rather disturbing information you're going to hear. The point you want to think about is that this appears to be a group which has very strong connections to our government or elements thereof. Ask yourselves whether what you're about to hear is the kind of world you want to have your children live in or perhaps live in yourself. Think very carefully about that.
Yeah, if you have any children up right now or if you yourself are weak of stomach, you might not want to listen to this next part. Again, this is a description of the Arliss Perry murder. Talking about, again, this is in the Stanford Memorial Church in 1974.
Again, just down the road. In fact, it was 13 years ago.
That's right. In the words of a church official who later viewed the scene, the site was, quote, ritualistic and satanic, unquote. And indeed it was a vision from hell. Arliss was lying on her back with her body partially under the last pew in the left side alcove, a short distance from where she was last seen praying. Above her was a large carving which had been sculptured into the church wall years before. It was an engraving of a cross. The symbolism was explicit. Arliss's head was facing forward toward the main altar. Her legs were spread wide apart and she was nude from the waist down. The legs of her blue jeans were spread-eagled upside down across her calves, purposely arranged in that manner. Viewed from above, the resulting pattern of Arliss's legs and those of the inverted blue jeans took on a diamond-like shape. Arliss's blouse was torn open and her arms were folded across her chest. Placed neatly between her breasts was an altar candle. Completing the desecration, another candle 30 inches long was jammed into her vagina. But that wasn't all. She'd also been beaten and choked. However, none of that butchery caused her death. Arliss Perry died because an ice pick had been rammed into her skull behind her left ear. Its handle protruded grotesquely from her head. Now, thoroughly unpleasant thing to have to think about, but again, these are the kind of people that we're talking about. This is the kind of thing that these people do, again, particularly to cause terror and revulsion, also to pass a message to people who would talk about their organization, as apparently Arliss Perry knew enough to have caused them some trouble.
We're going to talk about next week about some of the killings this group committed. It's a staggering, it's like the JFK assassination. However, again, as you think about whether or not you want to contribute your support to KFJC, just ask yourselves how many media voices are even going to deal with something like this. And again, those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it, and beyond that, those who never look at the past are also condemned to repeat it. And you would want to think very well, I think, particularly those of you who have children, whether you want them to wind up like Arliss Perry, or maybe you want your wife or girlfriend or somebody else to wind up that way, because the clock is ticking and you are not going to be able to ignore this kind of situation for very much longer. Think about that. Think about what's happening in America. Think about whether or not you want to support KFJC. Maury Terry closes his book with a very eloquent assessment of the situation in this country. Their numbers are growing, and this time, there is no insulating middle America. This time, it isn't an inner city eruption that can be written off as the inevitable fallout from poverty and slums. No, this battleground is elsewhere. The list of the dead tells that story. The killer cults were born and nurtured in the comfort zone of America and are now victimizing it at will. Manson's haunting testimony and a later warning from David Berkowitz echo loudly across the years. Two statements made on opposite coasts, nearly a decade apart. Yet the dire message is the same. What about your children? Manson challenged the Los Angeles courtroom as the 1970s began. You say there are just a few? There are many, many more coming in the same direction. They are running in the streets, and they are coming right at you. In New York, Berkowitz would write, "There are other suns out there. God help the world." Sometimes, late at night, one can know the truth of their words. Through the darkness, a foreboding wail can be heard. Faintly at first, then more insistent and near, the reverberations ring through urban canyons, roll across the shadowed byways of Scarsdale and Bel Air, and are carried on the night wind to the remote reaches of rural countrysides. It is a mournful, curdling cry. It is the sound of America screaming. Think about that. Think about what's coming. Think about whether or not you wish to have a media voice like KFJC in between you and that.
And we're going to take a look at cults and mind control cults in particular. this evening. We're going to begin by taking a look at a couple of journalists who were affiliated with the Unification Church who were killed in Afghanistan, and they were making a film about the Afghan War. We're going to take a look at some of their past work and discuss the Unification Church as an intelligence front very briefly. Then we're going to get into the actual material from The Ultimate Evil. For those of you who are not familiar with it, it's a book by Maury Terry, and it, in my opinion, is one of the most important books that's ever been published in this country. It doesn't go as far still as I would like to have seen it go, but perhaps that is inevitable, and perhaps it's not realistic to expect any one author to go that far. This book basically links many of the horrendous serial killings that have taken place in this country, such as the Son of Sam killings in New York, the .44 caliber killings, the depredations of the so-called Manson family, and points out that these are all links in a nationwide chain of conspiracy, and that the people who took the fall for these crimes, David Berkowitz and Charles Manson, while involved, were actually just bit players, and that the people actually committing these crimes are alive, free, and very wealthy, very powerful, and very, very well connected. It also appears, and this is perhaps the most disturbing thing, that these cults are perhaps fronts for some kind of intelligence activity, and that is a very disturbing thing to contemplate, certainly. It would be disturbing enough simply to think that these organizations were able to operate on their own, but the thought that something this evil and this bloody, the support of the national security establishment, is indeed unnerving. But we're going to be taking a look at that this evening. Most of the broadcast this evening from The Ultimate Evil is going to we're going to examine the various murders that were committed in order to cover up the original killings. In other words, we're not going to be going into the actual 44 killings themselves, or into the original killings at Cielo Drive in Los Angeles. Those were the Manson killings, the killings of Abigail Folger, actress Sharon Tate, and others. Nor are we going to go into the LaBianca killings. We're simply going to investigate killings or suspicious deaths that appear to have been committed by this organization to cover up the truth concerning their activities. And it's truly a numbing series of killings. We're going to deal with some, the better part of 20 apparent murders or suspicious deaths in connection with this case. And again, these are not the original killings themselves, but ones committed to cover up those crimes. Then we're going to take a look at the role of late Bronx District Attorney Mario Merola in covering up the Son of Sam investigation. Merola was one of the driving forces behind pushing for David Berkowitz to be allowed to plead guilty, in spite of the fact that there was abundant evidence that Berkowitz was not acting alone and may not have even been the main cog in this particular wheel, or this particular machine. We're going to take a look at Merola's role in fingering David Berkowitz as the lone nut in the Son of Sam case, and then we're going to take a look at some curious things which appeared in Mr. Merola's obituary. Merola died this past week, and we're going to take a look at the circumstances of his death. We're going to take a look at some of the cases he's heard in the past and his background in U.S. intelligence during World War II, and we're going to speculate about that a little bit. Then we're going to take a look at another case which Merola presided over and which has appeared in the news again this week, namely the third apparent clearing of former Labor Secretary Raymond Donovan. Merola was very much involved in that, as well as the Son of Sam case. That's what we have on tap for this evening. As I say, the prepared portion of this broadcast will ultimately be combined with the other material we've done on The Ultimate Evil to put together what basically will be a mini-archive show. Rather than reread the material, we're simply going to combine the various segments of the broadcast, and that will constitute the archive show. Now, the first article this evening comes from the New York Times of Wednesday, October 28th of 1987. This is a story that was covered by most local papers, so I'm sure many of you are aware of it. This is an article by William G. Blair, B-L-A-I-R, and it's headlined, Two Reported Killed on an Afghan Visit, subheaded, But the State Department Reports Conflicting Accounts of Film Journalist's Fate. The term journalist here should probably be in quotes, given the background of the individuals. The State Department said yesterday that it had received a report that two American film journalists were killed in Afghanistan this month while making a documentary about the civil war there. But a department spokesman said American diplomats in Islamabad and Peshawar in neighboring Pakistan were unable to confirm the report, which originated with an anti-communist guerrilla group that the Americans had reportedly been traveling with in northern Afghanistan. The spokesman, Arthur Berger of the Bureau of Near Eastern and South Asian Affairs, said the department had received conflicting reports on the fate of the two journalists and was also unable to confirm their identities. He said other information, which he declined to characterize, had been given to the American authorities that the two journalists had been captured by government forces, not killed. The Associated Press, quoting American diplomats and Afghan guerrillas, reported from Islamabad that the two journalists were Lee Shapiro, president of Shapiro Media Productions of North Bergen, New Jersey, and Jim Lindelof, L-I-N-D-E-L-O-F-F, a 27-year-old sound and cameraman from California. The AP said the film team and its guerrilla escort were ambushed near Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan, about October 11th, and that the two Americans were killed in the fighting.